From KQED Public Radio, this is the Capital Notes podcast for Friday, August 13th. Friday the 13th.
Is it a furlough Friday? We don't know.
I don't know.
Unfortunately, people will know by the time they hear the podcast, though. See? That's the problem with taping this on a Thursday.
Yeah.
Well, if it's a furlough Friday, you've got extra time to sit and listen to us ramble. And if it's not, get back to work.
Do it at work anyway.
Do it at work anyway. There you go. Yeah. I'm John Myers from KQED Public Radio, and two smart people, one and a half. I don't know. Are you half day? Or are you fully here, Anthony?
Are you counting yourself?
No, I'm not counting myself at all. I'm a zero. I'm a zero in that equation. Sitting in here, Anthony York, editor of Capital Weekly, blog king for the LA Times.
Dun, dun, dun.
And Juliette Williams from the Associated Press, who is our resident expert on the governor's race. Because you're covering it full time, right?
I am, indeed.
For better or for worse.
All Meg Whitman all the time.
And all Jerry
and
Brown.
And Jerry Brown sometimes, too.
And sometimes, occasionally. So we're going to talk about the governor's race. And since last week, our friend Kevin Yamamura from the B and I bored you to tears with the budget. We will start with the governor's race this week.
Okay.
And then Anthony and I will bore you about the budget. And we'll let Juliette go back to her paying job. So governor's race, you tell me what you make of this race at this point. We're sitting here a couple of weeks left in August, basically, 3 weeks left in August, two and a half. Does it seem odd to me? Is there an odd feel, an odd push? It just, I don't know. I can't quite get my hand around about what the status of this race is and whether, I don't know whether the public's paying attention yet, but what do you make of the back and forth with the candidates?
I mean, I think I would be surprised if the public was paying a great deal of attention right now. I think the jury,
nobody's reading our stories or listening to our stories.
Sure, they're eagerly awaiting each one. I mean, I think people care, but I think that so far it seems like Jerry has successfully managed to push this off until Labor Day, like he wanted to. I mean, the polls aren't moving.
Mm-hmm.
Meg's still spending lots of money, so that's good for all the people who make money off such things in the TV stations, but
political consultants, TV stations,
it's
yeah.
The slow time of August.
Well, let's talk about the money. So, because we didn't do a podcast around the money reports, does anybody even get shocked or surprised anymore by the money that she's raising? I mean, what do you think?
I think it's numbing. I mean, what was it, $91 million of her own money? Right, and she'd spent nearly $100 million total.
I called it 100. I think I added 99.7.
It depends. There's like three or four different ways to count it.
Right. And see, I thought you just have to count unpaid bills.
Was money raised, but then she had 10 in the bank. So yeah. Anyway, and that the numbers were a month old. Anyway, a lot. I think was the technical term.
Enormous, exorbitant amount of money.
Yeah,
yes.
I mean far surpassing anything we've ever seen in California. Nobody knows where this race will land in the national records of wealthy people spending their own money, or
gonna,
even not just her own money, but the money she raises, too.
It'll be the record breaker, I think.
You think over Bloomberg?
Bloomberg is only 108.
Well, it depends on whether you count it for a single race or over his whole...
See,
he's 108 for one race.
His most expensive race was 108 for his third mayoral campaign.
Right, let's just give it to her.
I mean,
let's just call.
I mean,
it
we're
right
nearly
now.
There. Yeah. They're probably there by now, right? Those reports were as of end of June.
Yeah,
so.
Those are 6 weeks old. Let's call it for her. But the money, and you and I have talked about this a lot, Anthony and Juliette. You tell me what you think. But again, the money she has spent. And the danger of that becoming part of the narrative, if it does really bleed into what the voters think about money she's spending and the money she spent and where the polls are. And she continues to say, and you and I saw her, Juliette, in the Sacramento suburb of Folsom, what, last week?
Yeah.
I believe it was last week.
Yeah.
You know, home of the prison and some outlet stores.
And Intel.
Exactly. The Sacramento Office of Intel. And she continued to say, well, I've got a plan. I'm executing it. And that's fine, except that, I mean, again, the polls don't show to me she's gotten what you would think she would have gotten for the money.
I mean, you would think that the numbers would move more. If you listen to her campaign, they emphasize all the time, look, this is a Democratic state. We're at a registration disadvantage. She's a newbie to politics. I would have thought that the numbers would move more than they have, and you know they're both polling high negative, so maybe people are just pissed in general. I don't know. They're still a quarter undecided according to public polls, so I think a lot of that goes to the are people paying attention right now? Is this a good investment of her money to be on the air full time in August?
Well, I was just saying, you know, a question I have, maybe Juliet has a better feel for this because she covers this full time, but you know, all this money has been spent. What is this race about? I mean, the level of discourse, you know, in terms of the issues, it seems to be so insipid. And maybe I'm just buried in the blog back and forth, you know, cataloging every single jab these campaigns throw at each other. But in terms of like an overarching narrative or taking on big issues, there doesn't seem to be a lot of substance to this race yet. I don't know if that changes and that sort of begins to take shape after Labor Day. But, you know, maybe, Julia, I don't know, do you have a different read on sort of the level of discourse of this campaign? Or?
I'm seeing the same stuff you're seeing.
Yeah.
And it is. It's very in the weeds and minutiae. And I don't know if that's them trying to get some interest from people like us to get involved in the race or to be writing about it more or
right.
You know, it's going to come down to the billionaire, independent businesswoman against the career politician, and it'll be those big characters. You're right. There hasn't been a great deal of engagement.
But what's interesting about if you try to look at the issues, because this is a great point. I mean, look at what issues are being talked about. The Whitman campaign, you know, continues to try to talk about the issues they want to talk about. Her glossy book talking about jobs and her three things that she wants to do, jobs, government spending, education. But they continue to do them in these events that are very structured, very formal events. I go back to the Folsom event again. It's an invitation only. People who worked for this startup company who asked her questions that, quite frankly, were softball questions.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
not – no offense to them. I mean, they're things they care about. But they're not questions that would push Whitman on how she intends to do stuff. She did a quick Q&A with the press, but it was a very quick Q&A with the press, which keeps them from the narrative that she's not talking to the press. But it doesn't really allow you to get into anything.
No.
So, you know, they would criticize those of us in the press for not covering those events every single one. But it's the same event over and over and over where it's – cast of characters that are all handpicked that go to them. Brown has no campaign events. He continues to do, you know, national TV interviews sometimes, and he drops policy proposals in the dead of the night on his website.
Wasn't that bizarre?
Yeah, talk about what that was that they dropped kind of weirdly on his website.
Well, they've done it, as Anthony pointed out, they've done it twice now where and I'm at a loss to figure out what they're trying to do. I mean, they need free media, presumably. The Whitman campaign's been critiquing them for weeks. You have no plan, you have no plan, you have no plan. And then they come up with this job creation plan and unveil it on his website at I don't know what time Saturday night. I was working Saturday. I didn't hear a word one about it. And then get virtually no coverage out of that.
It's almost as though they don't want to talk about the plan, but then they want to be able to say, well, we've got a plan, so she can't say that.
And maybe that's what it is. But you'd think if you're going to go to the trouble of writing a plan, you might at least want someone to write about it or talk about it.
You would think that. And they did it with their what was it? The education plan that was released via Twitter.
Same thing.
Yeah. Education and the environment was all rolled into one.
Yeah.
Both at the same time release?
Well, there was the green the energy plan, which had been released before. And then, you know, and talking to the Brown campaign about it, I mean, their reaction was, hey, when we unveil, I think it was when they released the energy plan the first time around, the story in the LA Times was about the fact that the Whitman campaign had a tracker in the audience. So they felt like they had, by releasing it on Twitter or releasing it just online with no fanfare, no event, that there was no meta story, no narrative story that would be written. It would have to be about the policy itself.
Except you would have to tell reporters about it for anyone to even write about it.
There is that. And then you get the meta story of what the hell is this guy doing? I mean, in terms of releasing these plans sort of in the dead of night. It's odd. But I think part of this is an experiment with, you know, Brown has his 1.1 million Twitter followers, and I'm sure three of them are sitting in this room now.
I just got one. No, I'm just kidding.
And, you know, and they got, I think they got what they wanted from the education. That's what's so
really
frightening. Yeah. Is that I think they did. I mean, they got coverage of it everywhere eventually. And it was on the policy itself. So,
well, and again, the quirkiness of the Brown campaign, which I guess has to be reflective of the candidate. I mean, you know, I think all of us in covering politics, at a certain point, the campaigns and the way they operate are somewhat reflective of the candidate.
Right.
You know, and maybe the Whitman campaign of the, you know, lots of people, you know, glossy this and that and presentation and marketing things do are reflective of her own style. So the quirkiness of the Brown campaign, you know, has got to be reflective of the candidate. But again, if you back up and look at this, and I think, and this was the point we were talking about just a minute ago in this, where we're sitting here on August 13th, Labor Day being the old-time traditional beginning of political campaigns, which we know really isn't the case anymore with the cycle of news and the way we go. And Brown seems to have gotten exactly what he needed to do, which he comes out of the summer largely at an even game or slightly better against right. a person who is who has five, six, seven times more money than he has. You know, you see where I'm going?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, in other words, he won the summer.
It worked.
I mean, I don't know how you can't say that Jerry Brown didn't win the summer.
And that was with an, a little assist that, you know, labor union spent about $6 million to to keep him afloat, and they figured that was enough. And they knew they wouldn't have to match Whitman dollar for dollar. They just didn't want Whitman to have the summer to herself. And you know what? If that money hadn't been spent, there would have been more of the stories that we've all seen, you know, about how Brown is doing nothing till Labor Day. If that Labor Independent Expenditure Committee wasn't there to fill the void, it would be that much worse. And there would be, I think, the sense that would be perpetuated by the free media. That's what we all are, right? Free media.
We work for free.
Yeah, just about. We podcast for free.
I'll work on that for you. Don't worry. That's now three or four times you mentioned. Let me call KQED.
Saying,
let me see what I can do.
That narrative would have been that much worse for the Brown campaign. There would have been a sense of spiraling. So,
and maybe he'd be down. Maybe he'd be down. I mean, they're still even in the polls. And I mean,
I think he wins the summer.
He wins the summer because I don't think anyone would have been surprised, including his own team, if he would have been behind at this point. And had to make up for it.
Now, let's talk. Go ahead.
I would say, you know, one of the interesting things about Brown that, and he's dropped these clues in a couple of interviews, and it really hasn't become part of the master narrative, and it hasn't become something that reporters have hammered him on yet. Is in a couple of interviews, I've heard him say now that he has a set of ballot initiatives that he's ready that he's ready to go. He's got plans for all. You know, you're going to break it up into five or six different pieces. I mean, it's very Schwarzenegger-esque what he's talking about. But the details of these plans have not, you know, it's like they exist in a vault somewhere, you know. And we haven't seen that at all. I mean, I've had conversations with the Brown campaign trying to get at some of that. But there's nothing there yet. So, maybe Juliet can help flesh that out for us.
I'll work on it. Maybe they're in the vault of Jerry's mind still.
Maybe we can gang up and pry a nugget or two loose sometime before November.
We'll go down there with torches in hand and stand outside. Exactly. But I want to talk about something else about the summer, because this does pivot us into, speaking of pivots, into another topic that's happened over the last week, and that is that Brown has been very lucky by Whitman having a battering of a storm on issues she has to deal with the base and the pivot between primary campaigns and general campaigns. And what we saw over this last week in particular was probably one of the most painful half hours I've ever heard of radio. Of Meg Whitman on the John and Ken show, talk radio host in Los Angeles.
I know. Did you hear Steve Poisner on the John and Ken show during the primary?
Fair enough. Fair enough.
You did say one of them.
One of the. I didn't say the most. I mean, because you start ranking times where candidates go on talk radio, and you know, and talk radio is an animal unto itself. We don't have to do a whole dissection of how talk radio works, but I called it bruising in what I wrote, and they liked that apparently, because then the next day they were on talking about all the coverage they got, and they referenced the blog posting where I called it bruising. But it felt like that, because at every point, you know, she – and this was all about immigration largely about immigration and her stance on immigration. And this is the kind of stuff that I think has helped Brown too. This is the stuff that's like the serendipity of Jerry Brown's efforts so far. I mean, wouldn't you say? Because this is the pivot where she had to talk about – immigration. Let me fill in all the blanks here. She had to talk about immigration in the primary in a way that she probably would have preferred not to, that Poizner pushed her on, about being more conservative, no amnesty ever. What do you do about undocumented immigrants? Can they have a path to citizenship or not? She was on John and Ken, and she said, I'm absolutely against a path to citizenship, which is tough because in October of 2009, she took a trip to the border where she said, can they get in line, pay a fine, and have a path to legalization? Her campaign insists, and I have trouble with it, but I'll have to take them at their word for now, insists that she never meant citizenship at that trip to the border in October 2009, that she was talking about a guest worker program.
They could join the Bracero program. Great.
Yeah. And I suppose because she set a path to legalization rather than a path to citizenship, though I would submit that people say those in the same breath in the rest of the world. Yeah. But John and Ken took her to task on her Spanish language media campaign that says she and Jerry Brown have the same position largely on illegal immigration. That's been a tough one for her. They've really had their hands full on that.
Well, and the irony was rich. She went to the John and Ken studio from opening her new office in East LA, mm-hmm. where she had some uncomfortable questions there. And I wasn't there in person, but by most accounts, it was pretty awkward and she wasn't quite on her game. And I mean, I give her props for being willing to go on. I'm not sure what she got out of it.
But that's
though.
A great question. Just for a second, we don't belabor this too long, but campaigns will like to say, look, she stood up to them. And I tend to think the other side, which is that talk show hosts, you know, they're in control of their show.
Mm-hmm.
They're in control of their show. And I don't know. At the end of the day, I'm not sure. I don't see what you get by going on.
Because the
waters seem muddier coming out than they did even going in. I don't know. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Well, and what is this really? Where's the base going to go? I mean, we are in a general election. They're going to support Jerry Brown, and they're going to
don't vote,
or they don't come out.
Maybe
that's what they're worried about.
Yeah,
that's
maybe.
What they're worried about.
But yeah, and perhaps that's true. But you know, I'm not sure that the base of the Republican Party is very different. You know, the conservative ideological base of the Republican Party is very different than, say, the labor base of the Democratic Party. The labor base, I mean, labor actually gets people to the polls. They spend money. They, you know, they have an aggressive get out the vote campaign.
That's what they're known for.
That's what they do. That's not true of the Republican Party. So I'm not sure. I mean, look at the statewide Republicans who have been successful in California. They've been the ones who have alienated the base, mm-hmm. at least enough, you know, enough to be able to get, I mean, to get support in the middle. I mean, Republicans are only, 32-33% of the registered voters in this state. Whitman needs she needs the base, but she needs another third, you know, on top of that.
But once again, so then why go back to John and Ken? Why not just stick to your strategy of, look, I'm moving past it. I'm opening my office in East LA. We're doing Spanish language media. Jerry Brown and I have the same views on immigration.
Right.
Period. So I just didn't see that.
Especially
that
when
seemed
you look
like
at,
she was trying to still work both sides.
Especially when you look at the polling that goes back to the primary, where we had these discussions about Poizner and his position, and was his position really reflective even of Republicans in the
right.
state?
Right.
And the polling indicated that a lot of Republicans are willing to go further than Steve Poizner was about finding a path to citizenship for undocumented right. immigrants, finding some way to deal with it. In which case, once again, that ultra-right position that's expressed by ultra-right members of the party, even John and Ken and people like that, doesn't, you know, right. Why go on? Why open that sore even more? I don't know.
Yeah. I wonder if that's changed. I mean, when that polling came out, that was before Arizona.
True.
That's
that
true.
Was before, you know, six more months of
and the
this
Arizona
economic
law
malaise.
Polls well in California.
Right, mm-hmm. right. So I think at least among the Republican base, the discussion around immigration may have changed since that PPIC poll in the spring. But whether or not it's a deciding issue in this campaign, I mean, I don't see it. But.
The other thing she said out of that interview that I just want to mention quickly, which was another one of these, okay, what do you do? You know, how does a conservative base work? Is at the very end of the interview, John and Ken started, you know, really going after her on climate change
right.
and Prop 23, which is the November ballot measure to suspend AB 32. Remember, that's how I know them.
23, 32.
Gotta love it.
Your dyslexia fits right in there.
I'm telling you, there's a benefit to everything. And just 2 days before that, two or three days before that, I had asked her the question of that little Q&A in Folsom about would she support Prop 23, which is what all the Republicans and the conservatives want to do. They want to suspend this climate change law. She wouldn't take it. She wouldn't take it. She moved around it. You know, she talked about she wants to do the temporary reexamination, yada, yada, yada. John and Ken had more success. And finally, at the end, she says, I'm leaning toward voting no. Which, you know, then the conservative Republican blogosphere went nuts with the, you know, she's not supporting where we are on this issue. Again, walking out of that studio, is she better off or worse off after than when she went in?
Well, and it seems to go counter to a lot of her economic arguments, which is what makes that one weird. I mean, immigration, it's kind of one of those hot button, like an abortion or, you know, you have your values. But a lot of the messages that she sends through her campaign would seem to be in line with Prop 23 and with the Chamber of Commerce that's backing that initiative. Yeah.
But then you look at the polling on that issue and, you know, in the abstract, I don't know about 23 specifically, but in the abstract, there's still widespread support. About 2/3 of Californians support AB 32.
Yep.
So, I mean, I think again, that's sort of the line that she's trying to walk.
And I think this is just, you know, bottom line, pivots can be tough from primary to general election. She's in a tough position because of a lot of reasons, not the least of which is the incumbent Republican governor who has walked a very interesting line of his own over the last 7 years. And Jerry Brown had no primary opposition.
Right.
And so he's got a relatively consistent message sitting over here that's the contrast is very stark.
And part of it is the inherent disadvantage that Republicans have in California. I mean, you know, they've got about 1/3 of the state's registered voters. A lot of the decline to state voters that are about 20% of the overall registration, a lot of those they lean Democratic anyway. And so what Whitman's campaign, I think, has tried to do, and you see this with the Latino outreach, is looking for pockets of voters in different places. And
micro-targeting.
And trying to string together, cobble together a collaged, you know, coalition of that would lead to 50%. And I think some of the things that we're discussing here sort of illustrate some of the problems of that strategy. Hmm. And that in turn has become a criticism of that Brown has levied against Whitman, that she says different things to different audiences, that she says one thing in Spanish and another in English. And, you know, and I think that, that'll be interesting to watch if that sort of line of attack continues over the next couple of months. We'll see.
Yeah.
Real quickly, and then we're going to let Juliet run back to her life.
Can I go too? Because I don't really want to talk about the budget.
I want you to talk about the budget. Come on. Everybody loves the budget. It's Sacramento.
Even the big five don't like to talk about the budget.
But really quickly, Meg Whitman here at the end of this week has been trying to make hay with Brown and his record. And again, it's the long, strange record of Jerry Brown. With the big fracas in the city of Bell in Los Angeles and these high salaries to these workers that every politician in California right now apparently seems to love the Bell train. Man, you jump on that train and you just ride that thing.
Hammer.
Yeah, everybody likes to say they're on the outrage side of that. But Meg Whitman has been pointing back to things that have gone on in Oakland, and she spent some time on that this week talking about the salaries of particular city officials in Oakland and saying, you know, Jerry Brown has his own dirty laundry of things like this. Does that what do you make of that and the back and forth on that so far?
I mean, so far I haven't seen anything that rises in any way to a comparable level of what we've seen in Bell. I mean, this was outrageous, and now I heard someone in one of the Bell groups is saying, don't use this. I mean, I'm sure they're a Democrat, right. So.
Yeah. This is the group, you know, led by Leo Briones, husband of former State Senator Martha Escutia, who's sort of pushing for the Bell recall stuff, this group BASTA. But yeah, now they're out there defending Jerry Brown, too. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's more of that micro-targeting that she's doing, and maybe it'll resonate with some people who are pissed in Bell.
And they're reasonable questions to ask about what went on in Oakland, because if you look at some of the stuff, if you look at the city administrator whose salary was huge and basically had carte blanche to do whatever she wanted, and, you know, you have to ask as the mayor whether you had technical power or not, don't you have an obligation to do something? So those are reasonable questions.
Sure, they're reasonable questions. Absolutely.
But scales of economy to Bell is...
Yeah, and I mean, this gives them an entree to talk about that, and I'm sure that there will be stories about what is Jerry Brown's record in Oakland. They're fair questions, absolutely. We're looking at a guy with a 40-year political career and lots of stones to overturn, but...
But is it fair to make a comparison to what happened to eBay salaries while Whitman was there? I mean, I understand it's public money versus private money. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, how are we supposed to judge Whitman? We have to look at her business record, right? So is it fair to go back and, you know, look at how eBay officers were compensated during that same time? I mean, I can understand why you might say no. That's not an apples-to-apples comparison. But I just wonder if we'll see any of that from the Brown campaign. I know they focused on her compensation and how her pay has increased while the value of eBay fell after the Skype purchase and all that stuff. You know, I think that Whitman's trying to sort of blunt any advantage that Brown has, you know, having the benefit of being attorney general and, you know, holding press conferences, announcing he's subpoenaing records. I mean, it's great for him. He keeps his name in the media and doesn't have to pay a cent for it.
And now the Republican L.A. DA gets to get on it.
That's
right.
Too.
They get to join forces.
They have a combined.
Steve Cooley, who's running for attorney general.
Right. Yeah. And now they've combined their investigations. So, hey, maybe it's the beginning of a beautiful working relationship between Cooley and Brown.
Well,
I'm sure Kamala Harris will be happy to hear about it.
Indeed. And all right. So with that, we'll let the governor's race go. And Juliet.
Bye.
Thank you for being here.
See you again soon.
Come back again.
Take me with you.
Okay, so Juliet's left. Let's talk about her.
Okay. Can you believe what she said?
I cannot believe that. Oh, my. Okay. All right, so in the interest of time, podcast listeners, because, hey, you know, you don't want to listen to an hour podcast, and we don't have an hour. Let's talk a little bit about budget stuff that happened. And this all, when you back out of all of this, we're still sitting here. Seventh week of a budget impasse.
Fifth
if you count the constitutional deadline of June 15th. Yes, fifth longest ever. We all read our chart about historical budget standoffs. But, you know, we're still sitting here stuck. I mean, we've got, you know, chitter-chatter of this and that and everything else. But one thing I wanted to get your take on quickly is that, and I wrote this in the piece that aired this week after we had the tax swap was brought up in committee.
Right.
And that is this tax issue, someone's going to have to blink.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a big blink because every bit of language and discussion and everything continues to build us up. I feel like pressure and pressure and pressure on the tax issue. Unlike some other years where Democrats have talked about taxes, but the rhetoric hasn't gotten to the point where it is now.
Right.
You know, the governor and the Republicans remain adamant about the tax issue. Daryl Steinberg, the president pro tem, on Wednesday said it to a group of reporters out in the hallway, because I asked him this. I said, you know, they're adamant. They're not going to change their position, the Republicans. He said, I'm even more adamant that we're not going to do the cuts that the governor's talked about to resolve the remaining few billion dollars, $4 billion or so, that apparently they haven't agreed on.
Right.
That's a lot of rhetoric getting built up here to where the blink is going to have to be big when we're playing this game of who's going to blink.
Right. And you know, it does make you wonder because in that $4 billion, right, the governor said, I think it was this week, that they're really only $4 billion apart.
Of the $19 billion that apparently $15 billion they've agreed on, which I'll believe it when I see it.
Right.
Go ahead.
That was the Republicans' take, too. But that $2 billion of that is going to be on the ballot in November. It's going, you know, this issue of the these corporate tax breaks that are scheduled to go into effect next year. So, you know, it does sort of point to this dragging out. I mean, perhaps through the fall, perhaps, you know, especially if you could have some sort of continuous appropriation, which has been discussed to avoid issuing IOUs, you know, the signs are not good. I mean, if you sort of look at what we've heard this week, right, we hear that, oh, yeah, by the way, the Senate Republican caucus is going to change leaders here in a couple of weeks, you know, come hell or high water.
Dennis Hollingsworth hands over to Bob Dutton from Rancho Cucamonga.
Which, that's never a good sign for progress, right?
Well, especially you don't when Hollingsworth apparently said to Jim Miller of the Riverside Press Enterprise,
well,
the whole negotiations
over.
Have to start over if it hasn't been finished by the time the new leader comes in.
You know,
oh,
and then the governor, of course, has a trip to Asia planned in early September.
That's right. Trade mission.
On the other side, you have the Education Coalition, which stood with the Speaker, John Perez, is now not supporting the budget. I don't know if that's a big issue. They're not aggressively opposing it, but they do not support the suspension of Proposition 98, the school funding guarantee, which in the new Democrats, you know, in the United Plan, the Dems are calling for a suspension of Prop 98. So, and we've seen members of the Education Coalition train their fire on people who are supposed to be their friends as well. So, maybe this is just part of blowing up a little bit before it comes together, but it just doesn't feel like this is moving in the right direction. And then on top of that, you've got legislative session that's about to end. You know, by August 31st, it's
constitutional end of the session,
and then that's not revisable, I don't believe. So,
would lead us to like a special session if you have to deal with the budget
for
after that,
things.
A lame
right.
duck session,
right?
In the middle of the election, but anyway,
right. And good luck with that.
Yeah.
So you have a governor who increasingly in public is thinking about his legacy. I mean, you know, you hear it from his communications team. You hear it, you know, their stories now are beginning to come out. And he's conscious of this, too. And so it's this is his last shot. And all of these things together are it's quite a traffic jam over there. And there's no real signs of movement.
And on the tax swap really quickly, because, I mean, you know, we've talked about this before. It's the swap. Income taxes go up. Sales taxes go down. The state pockets the difference. The car tax goes up as well. People get to money right. back from the feds on their tax return, et cetera, et cetera. Hopefully podcast people know enough about that plan. But
I'll draw a picture if you don't.
But we had this big Wednesday hearing where the ledge mm-hmm. analyst came out and said, you know, there's going to be a net tax increase with people all the way between $20,000 a year and $200,000 a year
right.
in earnings. That's a huge swath of the California population, and that – you know, only fueled the critics of this plan saying, ah, see, this is a horrible thing to do. And yet the Democrats come back and say, well, we're open to amending it. So why don't you give us an idea? You don't like it? Give us an idea. And again, I go back to the tax issue is that it's not
right.
surprising we're having a fight over taxes, but we just keep at every corner, we come back to the tax.
Well, look, the headlines today were, you know, the legislative analyst saying the Democratic proposal would increase taxes on the middle class. And it does not increase the income taxes on the wealthiest, you
right.
know, on the same level. Well, you know, what's so frustrating about this is if you listen to most, you know, listen to Republican rhetoric about taxes, and they and Democrats too, they want to take away volatility because our tax system is too dependent on rich people's income taxes. Well, what do you think that means? That means spreading the pain. I mean, that means that the people, the poorer people, people who make less, are picking up more of the tab. So isn't that what we're talking about when we're talking about making a more stable and fair and equitable tax system? Aren't we talking about taking the burden off the highest income earners and spreading that to everybody else? Isn't that what that means? Or what am I missing? Somebody please explain it to me. Because, I mean, that's what's so circular about the logic surrounding this budget sometimes is that people say completely opposite things when you put it in slightly different contexts.
And on that same line, I think you may have been picking up on this, so let me just join in on that comment.
Okay.
But also the notion, too, that reform can solve the year's budget problem.
Right. When
in fact, reform is reform, and it's not necessarily a win financially, because a great
right.
example came out of this in the hearing. The ledge analyst expert Jason Cisney, who knows all of the stuff inside and out, was talking about, you know, yes, we can make this less painful for those people in the middle class, but we do it, you know, so in other words, you can change this reform plan to make it kind of more fair or less egregious, whatever the way of saying it.
Right.
But the result will be less net money to solve this year's deficit problem,
right.
Which is, you know, this whole plan is concocted in part to give us money, you know, $3 billion or so, $2 billion, $3 billion to solve the budget deficit. And so the reform may be better by actually shrinking the amount of money it gives us, which goes back to me of the whole thing of like, you know, looking for a silver bullet reform that fixed
right.
the deficit too is impossible.
No, and I think right now it's sort of a political reform because the governor wants reform as part of a budget deal before he signs a budget. And so there's something that you have to be able to call reform in order to get a budget passed.
Right. And how do you define it? And is it broadly defined enough so that, right, you know,
right.
everybody walks away saying, hey, I got what I wanted out of this.
Right.
So
right.
we're really optimistic about the budget, aren't we?
Yes, totally. can't wait.
You know, and it's not like this is anything new. But again, it just, I think, as you said, bottom line, it feels really discombobulated. It feels really out there. And this whole thing is, you made a very good point. Every year, negotiations have to seem to blow up somehow before everybody comes together.
We're approaching the blow up.
But this is not a blow up because this isn't like two sides just saying, you know, walking like when you're buying a car and say, I'm done.
No, this is more of a meltdown.
Yeah, this is all falling apart in a million different places. Yeah. So, all right.
Like Inception.
Ooh, good. Movie plug.
Yeah.
All right, well, then I'll run out right now to go see it.
Good.
Okay, well, thanks, folks, for listening. And for Anthony York from Capital Weekly and Juliet Williams, who was with us earlier. Look, Anthony's already picking up his keys.
I'm out of here.
I'm John Myers from KQED. See you next time.